please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Headlines. The U.S. president calls his Russian counterpart a killer, saying that Moscow will pay a price for overmeddling in U.S. elections, a charge that Russia denies. U.S. officials say that six women of Asian descent are among those killed in a string of shootings in the state of Georgia amid growing violence against minorities. Also in the headlines, health officials in the occupied West Bank say the number of Palestinians needing hospitalization due to the coronavirus has reached a breaking point. Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. U.S. President Joe Biden has issued a stark warning to his Russian counterpart, saying Vladimir Putin will pay a price for what he called interfering in the 2020 American presidential election. Biden revealed that he had warned about a potential U.S. response during his January phone call with Putin. Biden vowed that the consequences would come soon. He also said that he thinks his Russian counterpart has no soul and is a killer. The comments followed a U.S. intelligence report that Putin had directed efforts to swing the 2020 presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. Russia has rejected the allegations as baseless and an attempt by Washington to create a negative image of Moscow. It says that the report is a pretext to impose new sanctions on Russia. Political commentator Tim Kirby says the U.S. spares no efforts to push Russia down, considering it is a threat to its objectives of being the world's sole superpower.
Well, let me put it this way. There's a new expression that if you're a Republican, you hate China. If you're a Democrat, you hate Russia. And that sort of logic seems to hold very true. And Biden is definitely not an exception to that rule. And he has been very strongly anti-Russian, and especially all the actions of him and his son in the Ukraine. That's basically the way it is. One could argue that it would be in the interest of the United States to have better relations with Russia, but there are people who don't feel that way. If the objective is for the United States to be the sole world hyperpower, then the rise of Russia is absolutely unacceptable to them, and that is probably why for the last 10 or so years, the West has really been trying to continuously push Russia down with any half-hearted excuse that they can dream up. The process of continuing sanctions has gone unabated, like I said, since the Ukrainian Revolution in 2014, so there's really no particular sign that any of this would stop anyways. It didn't stop under Trump.
China has slammed the U.S. for imposing sanctions on 24 senior Chinese officials, urging Washington to end its interference in the country's internal affairs.
The U.S. side's attempts ahead of the dialogue to control the tempo and put pressure on China will not succeed. China resolutely opposes and condemns this and has already carried out necessary countermeasures.
The foreign ministry spokesman also said the U.S. move fully reveals its sinister intentions. The U.S. measure came ahead of a cliffhanger meeting between American and Chinese officials in Alaska, which will be the first diplomatic overture since President Joe Biden entered the White House. Meanwhile, the Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced that Washington plans to take an uncompromising stance in the talks. The two top economies remain at odds over a host of issues, including trade, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. Okay, the piece of breaking news there concerns an official from Iran, top security official, making a reaction or having a reaction to what the U.S. has done. In this case, West hypocrisy, he has said, has caused current deadlock regarding the JCPOA. There are some additional details behind this piece of breaking news. If we can, well, there you go. The Supreme National Security Council is holding a meeting now based on the response of the U.S. in terms of the continuation of its sanctions. And there's another piece of detail behind this piece of breaking news, which I think is coming here, and that's it, denouncing the U.S. linking of the sanctions to the removal of to Iran's internal affairs. So the U.S. linking sanctions removal to Iran's internal affairs, another reason why this denouncement has come, and perhaps one reason behind the meeting that's going to take place. As tensions grow with the United States, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has unveiled a new underground missile city. What message is the Islamic Republic sending out with this latest display of military might? Tehran's enemies regularly claim that all options are on the table when it comes to Iran. But with so much firepower on Iran's table, is that really the case?
Iran has disclosed a new secret underground missile city. The naval force of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage of the site during a ceremony attended by high-ranking military commanders. On display are scores of different crews and ballistic missiles. The IRGC forces have also been equipped with a vast number of advanced missile systems and equipment. These include 360-degree firing power, the ability to launch mines at different ranges, mobile launchers, and radars to detect signals from enemy warships. This is in addition to missile systems capable of changing targets once the projectile has been fired. Military officials say the technology will increase the existing combat power of the IRGC, and that they have all been designed indigenously by different factions of Iran's defense sector.
Every military planner wants as much secrecy as possible. But at the same time, you can only stop an enemy from attacking you if they know that you're not weak. So it is very important to show the military capabilities and capacities that Iran has. And Iran's military is a very strong military, and it's very capable of retaliation if provoked. And this is the message that the display of these incredibly modern weapons shows. Every enemy of Iran knows that if they should attack, they will suffer debilitating defeats, and if they attack Iran, then they cannot do so without being punished.
The IRGC's chief commander, Major General Hossein Soleimani, says, "What we see today is a small section of the great and expansive missile capability of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps naval forces. The revelation of the missile city comes as Washington and Tehran remain at a standoff over the future of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal."
Where Iranian military commanders say this is just a fraction of the country's underground missile cities. What was not disclosed is the location of the site. However, Tehran had said in the past that it has underground missiles facilities all along its Persian Gulf coast. Iran also says it has missiles that can travel over much of West Asia. That places all U.S. military bases in the region, as well as Israel, within their range.
Despite being under the toughest sanctions regime by the United States, Major General Soleimani says the Islamic Republic has made major technological achievements in the defense industry. He pointed out that the Iranian nation has managed to resist and overcome sanctions without any fear. The commander also says the delivery of the new equipment to the IRGC's Navy before the end of the current Iranian calendar year proves the country's defensive power is constantly growing. The IRGC's chief noted that Iran's military power represents the biggest deterrent to enemy plots. The U.S. and Israel often boast that all options are on the table when it comes to dealing with Iran.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has never been defeated in war, and this is unlikely to change. The people of Iran fought back the armies of Saddam Hussein back in the First Gulf War, that armies that were supported by the United States and by Germany, among others. So since then, the army has only strengthened. They have gained experience, they have gained new weapons and new capabilities, and it is impossible for any nation to successfully invade Iran. Of course, anyone could attack, but they know that they cannot do so without paying a very heavy price. And this is something that every power in the region, whether it be Israel or Saudi Arabia, knows.
Iran has always said its missile program serves its defensive needs. By the same token, Tehran says it will not hesitate to use them should it need to defend its sovereignty. This was highlighted in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, in the vicinity of Baghdad International Airport. On January 8, 2020, the IRGC retaliated by striking the Ain al-Assad military base in Iraq, where U.S. troops are stationed. It was the largest ballistic missile attack ever against American forces in history. Each missile was reported to have carried a warhead weighing more than 1,000 pounds. Speaking to U.S. media, military personnel who were at the base at the time of Iran's response said that words can't even describe the amount of energy that is released by these missiles.
And finally, another detail behind the breaking news that we've been going on, and this from the Supreme National Security Council. Well, this one's saying that it's holding a meeting, but basically the other piece that's coming from the Supreme National Security Council is the fact that the U.S. needs to lift all sanctions. That is the conclusion based on some of the pieces of breaking news that the National Security Council has had. Okay, six women of Asian descent have been killed in a string of shooting incidents in the U.S. state of Georgia. That has raised concerns about growing violence against minorities. The women were among the eight victims of three attacks around the city of Atlanta. South Korea has confirmed that four of the victims were of Korean descent. Police have detained a white man, Robert Aaron, on the suspicion of staging all the attacks. Georgia state officials say that they have not yet determined any motive behind the crime. However, they say the bloodshed matches a quote pattern of violence against Asian Americans during the coronavirus pandemic. Advocacy groups say that attacks against the minority groups have spiked markedly after the COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S., with women and the elderly being the prime targets. The U.S. says it's facing the biggest increase of migrants at its southwestern borders in 20 years. The Secretary of the Homeland Security says the number of attempted border crossings from Central America and Mexico has steadily increased since April of last year. Alejandro Mayorkas says most single adults and families are being turned away. Republican critics have blamed the policies of the new administration for the current crisis. Amid rising criticism, President Joe Biden has urged migrants not to come to the U.S. Poverty, violence, and corruption in Mexico and some Central American countries have made people set journeys to the U.S. in hope of a better life. The Palestinian health minister says the coronavirus situation in the occupied West Bank has reached a breaking point as hospitals already under intense pressure are flooded with patients. Maya Al-Kaila described the situation as alarming and dangerous. In the West Bank, more than 156,000 coronavirus cases and nearly 1,600 deaths have been recorded so far. The Palestinian Authority has already said that a new wave of patients is exceeding its ability to cope. The PA took the delivery of 60,000 Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines via the UN's COVAX program. This is in stark contrast to Israel, where normality is gradually returning. This as the regime is pushing ahead with one of the world's most intense vaccination campaigns for its own population, except some Palestinians who have Israeli work permits. Israel has been criticized by human rights groups for ignoring the suffering of the people under occupation. The European Union has threatened to curb the export of COVID-19 vaccines amid a row with the UK over the delivery of jabs to the bloc.
We want reliable deliveries of vaccines. We want to increase the contracts. We want to see reciprocity and proportionality in exports, and we are ready to use whatever tool we need to deliver on that. This is about making sure that Europe gets its fair share. We will invest even further in Europe's capacity also beyond.
Ursula von der Leyen added that all options are on the table to halt exports to countries which have higher vaccination rates than the EU, including the UK. Brussels has accused Britain, the main producer of AstraZeneca vaccines, of operating a de facto export ban to achieve its vaccine success. But London has rejected the claim. The EU faces an acute squeeze of COVID-19 jabs due to reduced deliveries by AstraZeneca and amid fears over the safety of the vaccines.
Fresh chaos in the European Union's sluggish coronavirus vaccination drive, beset by delays and supply shortfalls in recent months. Questions about the safety of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine after reports of suspected deaths due to blood clots forming after inoculation.
We have decided to make a temporary and precautionary suspension for the next few weeks so that the European Medical Agency can evaluate in detail these cases and so that the national pharmaceutical agencies can offer an answer to these signals.
a move adopted by dozens of other EU nations, hailed by some as the right thing to do, and criticized by others for fueling vaccine hesitancy among people already wary of coronavirus jabs. But on Monday, reassuring words from the World Health Organization.
This does not necessarily mean these events are linked to vaccination, but it's routine practice to investigate them. And it shows that the surveillance system works and that effective controls are in place.
The EU's own medicines regulator, EMA, has also made it clear the reported side effects and deaths needed to be investigated carefully. Scientists at Oxford University and AstraZeneca say of the more than 17 million people who have received the vaccine in the UK and the EU, fewer than 40 cases of blood clots have been reported as of last week. This is not the first time the Oxford AstraZeneca jab is running into trouble. The recent EU move comes against a backdrop of concerns raised about how the vaccine data have been released, and some European leaders, including French President Emmanuel Macron, have questioned its effectiveness. The British Prime Minister has defended his government's flagship coronavirus jab, but experts say a discontinuation of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine would deal a serious blow to the UK's prestige. Both the World Health Organization and the European Medicines Agency insist the benefits of the jabs outweigh their risks. All eyes now on the outcome of reviews of available data by WHO and EMA experts this week to decide whether the vaccine has indeed caused blood clots in those inoculated, or have those events only been a coincidence. Saeed Puriza, London.
Since Doha talks failed to bring peace to Afghanistan, the country's peace process is pursued in Moscow, this time with the participation of key local, regional, and international players.
Representatives of the Afghan government, influential political leaders, the Taliban, and some key regional and international players have decided to continue negotiations on the fate of the Afghan peace trend in Moscow. There are two main scenarios on the negotiating table at the Moscow summit in order to bring peace to war-ravaged Afghanistan.
The first scenario for the transition of power from President Ashraf Ghani is to establish a transitional government. This scenario has so far been backed by some players, including Russia, the US, Pakistan, and China.
However, experts here believe the second scenario that will most probably gain support from Iran and India follows another solution, which is holding an early election for the transition of power. This comes while war-weary Afghans say, as their country has entered a very different phase of its history, it's too important for influential political leaders to make a united front and convince all players to just put an end to war at any cost.
Our country is bleeding and it needs help from all those who are involved in the Afghanistan crisis. But we want our own leaders to set aside their differences and lead the country to lasting peace.
Locals here also call on the Taliban to respect people's demand and honestly work on a true peace plan if they are not serving foreign players.
The Taliban needs to realize that there are no military solutions to the crisis, so it should say no to foreign demands that are against Afghanistan's national interests and closely work with others to bring calm and stability to Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that the Afghan government had already rejected Russia's agenda regarding the Afghan peace process, and now another summit is slated to be held in Turkey in 2 weeks. The Turkey conference will also work on the Afghan peace process, but only time will tell whether those meetings can lead the country to peace and stability. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Israeli regime can do whatever it wants with the U.S. backing. But when Palestinians protest precisely because the U.S. will not do nothing to defend them, then they are at fault, says James Zogby, writer, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Policy Ignores Palestinian Human Rights. Stay tuned for more. Over the years, the approach of most American policymakers toward the Israeli regime-Palestinian conflict has been Israeli regime-centric with near total disregard for the suffering endured by the Palestinian people. The architects of policy in successive U.S. administrations have discussed the conflict as if the fate of only one party, that is the Zionist regime, really mattered. Israelis were treated as full human beings with hopes and fears, while Palestinians were reduced to a problem that needed to be solved so that Israelis could live in peace and security. It is not just that Israelis and Palestinians haven't been viewed with an equal measure of concern. It's worse than that. It appears that Palestinians were judged as less human than Israelis and were therefore not entitled to make demands to have their rights recognized and protected. Operating from this mindset, the U.S. has given the occupying regime of Israel carte blanche, while pressure and punishments have been reserved for the Palestinians. On occasion, policymakers have timidly raised the issue with some Israeli regime practices, but because they have taken no effective measures to change these behaviors, the Zionist regime has seen no reason to alter its course. As a result, the fake regime of Israel operates with impunity, while Palestinian actions have been scrutinized and condemned, and their protests have either been ignored or silenced as disruptive or counterproductive. Recent actions by the Biden administration sadly fit this pattern. In just the past few weeks, they have condemn the decision of the International Criminal Court, ICC, to begin prosecution of the regime of Israel for its war crimes in Gaza since 2014 and its illegal settlement expansion in the West Bank. Criticized the UN Human Rights Council for its condemnation of Israeli regime abuses of Palestinian human rights. Rejected tying U.S. aid to Israeli regime's human rights behaviors. Declared opposition to Palestinian calls to boycott, divest, and sanction the Israeli regime for its violations of Palestinian rights. Especially revealing was one of the reasons given for U.S. opposition to Palestinians taking their complaints to international fora. The U.S. charged that such actions against Israel increase tensions and undercut efforts to advance a negotiated two-state solution. This appears to suggest that the Zionist regime's aggressive land confiscation, settlement construction, demolition of Palestinian homes, detention without charges or trial of hundreds of Palestinians, collective punishment of the entire population of Gaza, and the Zionist regime's mass killing sprees of Palestinians in 2014 and 2018 did not increase tensions or undercut efforts at peacemaking. But Palestinians seeking legal remedies against these Zionist actions is disruptive. In short, the Zionist regime of Israel can do whatever it wants with U.S. backing. But when Palestinians protest precisely because the U.S. will not do nothing to defend them, they are at fault. Regardless of the U.S. intent, what this says to the Palestinians is that their human rights don't matter and will always be subordinated to Israeli interests. Listen to this exchange at a recent State Department briefing. A reporter asked, "Considering your position on the Palestinians now, where should the Palestinians go to get accountability for what they claim to be a problem?" The State Department official responded, "Of course, the United States is always going to stand up for human rights. That is why you have heard us continue to endorse a two-state solution to this long-running conflict, because it protects Israel's identity as a Jewish and democratic state, but it will also give the Palestinians a viable state of their own and fulfill their legitimate aspirations for dignity and self-determination," unquote. Because the answer was non-responsive to the question asked, the reporter repeated 13 times, "Where do they go?" No further reply was given. The best this administration has so far offered the Palestinians was the reiteration of a vague commitment to a negotiated two-state solution. But this remains hollow as long as it fails to address the complete and abusive control of the Israeli regime exercises over Palestinians and their land, and the U.S. refuses to apply pressure to end these Zionist regime abuses. Even more telling was a policy address on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict delivered by a U.S. ambassador at a recent meeting of the U.N. Security Council. It was so Israeli regime-centric that any acknowledgement of Palestinian concerns were either accompanied by kibitz or framed in terms of Israeli regime's interest. For example, the ambassador expressed the hope that Israelis and Palestinians would both get COVID-19 vaccines, but sidestepped any mention of the Israeli regime's refusal to accept its responsibility to do this. He recognized the unsustainable disparity in economic development between Israelis and Palestinians, but weirdly attributed this to a structural issue that should be diagnosed and addressed, without acknowledging that the structural issue has a name: occupation.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Inside Israel. The social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But of course, we know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities, such as, for example, Bnei Brak. As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence and increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short-term, which relates to the corona. The long-term is the attack on institutions, mainly by Netanyahu, over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. The people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. So you can see the results in the decline of trust, and in the short term relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor, and just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat, and we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, and we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years, no wonder people lose trust. And when they lose trust, this is very dangerous. So I agree, this is a great, great danger to Israel, the internal crisis, the internal feud. First of all, there's all division between secular Jews or non-Orthodox Jews and Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. This has a long history of there's a community that pay less taxes. They don't study the core issues like math and English, etc., which are necessary to modern world. Many of the men don't work, and they don't serve in the army like all of us. I served, my children served, and my granddaughter now is in the army. So to look at a community that doesn't take part in the national effort is very infuriating. Come the corona, and you see these people defying the orders of the Ministry of Health, and they are getting infected. I think the Israelis would have accepted anything if they had leadership who would tell them, you know what, everybody has now to pay something. People who can, people who make a lot of money should have paid, should have been taxed, to help others survive this. But you need leadership for this.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Shimon says, an economic and social crisis in Israel. No services for welfare for 2 weeks. Leo says, Israel starting war to cover the economic and social crisis in Israel. Thousands of Israelis renewed weekly demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for the long-serving Prime Minister to resign over corruption charges against him and his alleged mishandling of the coronavirus crisis.
Public, it has no belief in its officials, in its government, in all the government offices. There's no belief in them, in none belief. The police's enforce is using extra power on children, on elderly, on just people that are in the streets. On one hand, and on the other hand, other people do whatever they want. Nobody believes anybody anymore. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. And the thing is, why the people went down to the streets is because the disbelief. And what a lot of people, not all of them, but a lot of people are saying, we do not want to go back to, it's in Hebrew, it's called the old good state of Israel. We do not want to go there because it wasn't good for a lot of us. It wasn't good for the Palestinians. It wasn't good for the Mizrahim, it wasn't good for the Ethiopians, it wasn't good for a lot of people, basically. It wasn't good for the poor. So basically, I think people are saying, we want something that is completely new. We don't trust any of the politicians that are changing parties from, you know, they've been in this party, and now they want to go in this party, and now they're separating and they're combining. Most of the public does not believe the public figures in Israel almost anymore. There's no trust.
The effects of the political and economic crises and the strength of their negative effects largely stem from the way they were managed. Israelis blame the regime for the mismanagement of the coronavirus crisis. Opinion polls have recently showed the existence of a loss of confidence in the regime, Israel's leaders, and institutions. This loss of confidence has negatively affected the Israeli population's readiness to implement anything the regime tells it. Businesses, including restaurants, have failed to adhere lockdown procedures. The poll also shows that most Israelis support the continuation of the demonstrations and protests. This even in the backdrop of their deteriorating economic and social conditions. This is, of course, a huge threat to the Israeli regime. The demands of the protesters have begun with the downfall of Netanyahu, but these protesters have went on to ask for the dissolution of the cabinet and Knesset and a fourth election. In December, their demands are met. Now, with a fourth election set for March, the weekly anti-regime protests still continue with more people joining. A recent survey by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 83% of Israelis believe that there is no social solidarity there. According to this poll, 74% of Israelis say that they do not trust parliament, that is the Knesset, and cannot rely on it in the face of the pandemic. 70% do not trust the cabinet, 63% of them do not trust finance ministry officials, 51% of them do not trust the police, and 47% do not trust the Ministry of Health.
A statesman is not a politician. A statesman thinks about the future of the country and what's good for the country. The politician thinks about the next election and what's good for him. And what we see today, we have politicians. We don't have the statesmen. We don't have the people who give us a vision. Just think about the Israelis today, they don't have hope. There's nobody they believe in who can speak to them and tell them the truth. If it's hard, Israelis know to go through hardships, but they need leaders, statesmen, to believe in. And we don't have these people right now. So let's see what happens in the next elections. I believe, I look at the protest, the hundreds of thousands of Israel taken to the streets, and there are some people who are doing it for week after week, you know, in the cold weather, rain or shine. And I know many of the young people who go to the process, and I see a lot of potential there. So, and also I'm a sworn optimist, so I believe that we will see a new generation of people emerging out of this crisis and taking over. I think Israelis want a direction. Israelis are willing to go through a lot of hardships, but show us where we are going. If you look at the, for example, the handling of the current corona crisis, the businesses are closing down. People are laid off. I don't know if they when the corona goes away, they will find any job anymore. And in the meantime, our leaders throwing money like from the helicopter on everybody, people who need it, people who don't need it, with no any plan of how we make a crisis into an opportunity. For example, strengthen the public health system. The reason why we survived this crisis is because we have Kupot Cholim, we have the public health organization, which are so strong and so accessible to the public. Look at the vaccination, how well it goes, because we have all those organizations which have been shrinking over the years because of lack of funds. And suddenly we have so much money to throw on everybody instead of investing in the public health system.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Sir Distick on Twitter says the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that individual members of the Israeli security forces, in the course of their response to the demonstrations, killed and injured civilians who were neither directly participating in hostilities nor posing an imminent threat. Yehi asks, what about the demonstrations against Bibi, the ones going on for months all through this pandemic? Jankowski says thousands of Israelis renewed their weekly demonstrations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him to step down as Tel Aviv went into third COVID-19 lockdown. Since last year, Israel has been witnessing demonstrations everywhere.
It's a mistake to think that the public was out in the streets only to demand only to demand that the government will be dispersed. And it was a mistake, and there's also a mistake. A lot of people think that the demand is to interrogate all kinds of things, like the selling of the submarines or the buying of the submarines also to Egypt or to whoever. I'm not too involved in that issue. I think a lot of the public, some of the public is out there saying we want a government that is not corrupt. But a lot of people are out in the streets, or a lot of people are not out in the streets, but basically they feel that they do not want to go back to business as usual. They do not want any government. And also there's something I didn't mention, because on the last elections, one of the Kahol Levan party received a lot of voices. They received a lot of people voted for them, and the hope was that they would send Netanyahu to trial or to, you know, or home, basically. And they sold the public. They went into coalition with the Netanyahu government. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. People feel that the vaccinations, a lot of people are happy to take them, but a lot of people feel that the vaccinations, the fact that Israel has been receiving so many vaccinations, people feel that Israel is like, is the government is allowing people to be, the companies to do experiments on people here in Israel. So basically, the sense of disbelief is tremendous all over. And actually, when you look at what's happening around in Israel, you see the Palestinians for 48, talking Umm El Fahim and cities within Israel. They're it's an uprise now. They're in the streets. There's police. Children of 14 years old are being arrested violently. You have these collisions with the Nebak, with the Orthodox cities. You have it almost everywhere. Israel is extremely in unrest all around. There's nothing, you know, we've been out in the streets for 30 weeks now in Balfour in Jerusalem, but not only there. So basically, there's a big the society is in a situation of unrest. And also people feel that the fact that they were going to elections in the fourth time in 2 years, it's the feeling that there's no government. There's no head of police. There's all kinds of positions that are not occupied because the government, Netanyahu, is not, the government isn't functioning.
Israel has lost control of coronavirus for several reasons, the annual strategic assessment of Israel said. The most important of which is the loss of internal political stability and the failure of the Israelis to respond to the instructions of their regime. To this day, much of the Israeli public believes the coronavirus is a natural disaster, mainly due to their distrust of the regime. But it is important to note that these issues only shed light on underlying crises that have been ignored. Now, the social problem is a national and strategic security threat for Israel, one that has shaken the highest echelons of the regime.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.